Hello and welcome to Read On, the show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios.
But not this week. This week we are... Well, where are you, Red?
I'm in my bedroom, in a cupboard, to try and keep the echoes down. And it's almost as well soundproofed as the studio is, I suppose.
Yep, I'm in my bedroom as well. So for the next few read-ons, they're going to have a more homemade feel.
Indeed, back to the early days of radio.
But fortunately, before the lockdown, here's something you recorded earlier. Cue the music.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On. I'm your host, Red Sale, and though we may be restricted in how much we travel at the moment, books know no boundaries. So this week, let us take you away across continents and time. We'll go down under and meet Maribel Steele and her book, Blindness for Beginners. As Belgravia follows Downton Abbey onto our TV screens, we'll recall how Julian Fellowes used Dickensian methods in its publication in print and audio, and I'll delve into a sensational Victorian melodrama. That's all coming up in today's show. 30 years ago, when I learned that I had retinitis pigmentosa, something that was sadly lacking was any kind of guidebook for what to expect and how to cope with it. Blindness for Beginners is exactly that, an anecdotal guide for living with degenerative sight loss. It's both honest and wonderfully warm, as is its author, Maribel Steele, who joined me via Skype from her home in Melbourne, Australia. Maribel Steele, welcome to Read On.
Hello, Red. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I can't believe how clear the line is to Melbourne.
That's fantastic. We could be in the next room.
Absolutely. Well, we do share an eye condition in retinitis pigmentosa.
That's right. And actually, I started to lose my sight a little bit around the time that you were losing yours. I read that you were losing your sight around 20, and I got my diagnosis around the age of 17. So it was not something that I welcomed. It was very difficult to take at that time. And the book is really to share the story, the journey of what it's like to receive that diagnosis, and then really how to turn it around and to see beyond any disability and just to really live the life you want to live.
Yes, it's very honest. You don't dress it up. There are some very difficult things that we all have to cope with. The thing that really resonated with me is not only the frustration of being a visually impaired parent of small children, but also the occasional feelings of shame.
Yes, shame and guilt. There's a story that I've written about, which with parenting, where I couldn't look after or see my children in the playground, and that feeling of guilt that, you know, what happens if they fall and I don't see them, and I'm relying on other people to give me this very important information. But often I find, well, when I look back now, that shame is obviously something that I took on myself. And later on, I just actually was able to see that when we let others help us, when we collaborate with people, there's a rich experience in that exchange. But yes, there was lots of frustrating times as a mother. I felt that I wasn't able to do things like other mothers. But like everything, I found other ways around the obstacle and developed a different way of communicating by being more tactile with my children. And they basically, that was their normal life. So for my children, there was nothing different at home. This, their mummy couldn't see.
Yes, they know no different. And it's about problem solving, both from our point of view and also our children and those others around us.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Problem solving, I think, is our default. Every day we are problem solving.
The other thing that really comes through is the creativity that arises from that. When you can't read your son his storybook, he's quite happy to have a story that's made up by you. When you can't see the sunset, you're quite happy to use your visual memory and create a sunset for yourself.
That's right. That's in that story, Imagining a Sunset Sky, which is an audio excerpt that will soon be available on my website. But that's describing this very interesting thought that when I'm looking at something like a sky, one day I thought, am I actually seeing the changing of the colour? Or is my brain expecting it to be a certain way? So it was almost like I was observing a dialogue between my brain and my eyes, having this discussion. What do you think the colour of the sky is? Well, it could be blue, but it's hot, so maybe it's pink. Yes, it's pink. And very oddly, that happens to me a lot. So if I'm looking at something and I can't see it, my brain can really suggest something. And it's only until I touch it or I can get closer that then I'm able to discern it better. So the brain really can play tricks on us as well. It can help, but it can also lead us astray.
I love your logical deduction that comes through your writing. Like all the best guidebooks to anything, you use logical deduction to take the reader through the steps. And it's something I really wish I'd had 30 years ago, a touchstone to help me take the very small steps that you have to take when you first learn of your degenerative eye disease.
And it is important, I like to share with people, that when something like this happens, to really go step by step. At first, naturally, you're going to be a bit like you've fallen off a horse, you really hit the ground hard, but ultimately, you do need to get up and you do need to find the resources and support that will help you go step by step. And when we can be logical, I talk about even organizing the home when it's in a certain way where everything has its place. Your sense of confidence is strengthened when you know where things are, even if you can't see. So being logical is actually a very good way of being when you have a visual disability.
And being prepared to ask for help and not batter yourself against the I have to do this all myself feelings that naturally flare up.
That's right. And look, to accept help, especially when you're out and about, I've learnt now that it's so much quicker to accept help when someone might see me standing on a corner and obviously look like I'm looking for something. And if they offer their help, I always like to take that because it just makes my life easier. But I've also learned that people get a nice sense of satisfaction too, that they've been given a chance to show their generosity. And in a world where we're not meant to talk to strangers, when you're vision impaired and you're out there, it breaks down the barriers. It's a very interesting thing. People can trust you because obviously you don't seem to be a threat, and suddenly you can be having these great conversations with total strangers.
I've always found that that actually is the greatest pleasure of having lost my sight, is that I have a lot more random conversations with fun people.
I know, they just sidle up next to you and you're having these conversations. I have that in the supermarket all the time. People will see me looking at something. I often take potluck. I like to do this little thing sometimes where I just think, I'm going to choose something off the shelf and I don't know what it is and I'll find out later. But somebody was watching me the other day and she said, can I help you? And I thought, oh, maybe I'll just check this time. So she told me what it was. But I like to play that little game.
It wasn't anything too bad, was it? You hadn't strayed into the dog food aisle or...
No. It was a type of sauce for pasta. And actually, I was really pleased. It was a Thai curry. So there you go.
You are a very keen cook, aren't you?
I am. Didn't used to be because I was feeding four children and a husband and a mother-in-law, and it was a bit of a chore. But through that having to cook for my family, I have really developed a love for cooking. And that's something that I like to share with people also in my book, in giving them a way of just being practical within your kitchen. And I've learned that there really are recipes and things we can make with our eyes closed. You just have to have more sense about you. For instance, one pot wonders. You know, cook things in one big pot. That can often save a lot of touching things. And there's ways to cooking. And yes, I do like cooking.
And the proof of good cooking is always in the way it tastes. And that is a sense we both still have.
Yes, oh, very much so.
So you're constantly dipping into your one pot.
Shh, don't tell anyone.
Cook for five, serve for four.
Something like that, yes.
You grow quite a lot of your own ingredients. You were telling me the rather terrifying story that you plant garlic in your snake-infested garden.
Yes, we have a bush block and we went there recently and I had all these garlic bulbs. And because we're in Australia, up in the bush there, it is a place where snakes live. But I wasn't planting in snake season. I don't think I would go out there if it was the height of summer. So as we're now going into autumn, I felt it safe and I was able to plant the garlic in our snake garden.
What about the spiders?
I don't see them. So I can't be worried about them.
And what's your favourite meal to cook?
Depending, I think, on the season. But one that's really lovely actually is a beautiful Thai pumpkin soup. It's a very easy thing. It's got lots of spices, feeds a lot of people. And so that is one. Spaghetti bolognese is a family favourite. And maybe even some chicken paella. So there's a few there.
And there are some recipes in the book?
No, not so much recipes, but that is a thought for another book. I talk more about how to organise the kitchen. So I give tips on the best ways to bring in extra lighting, how to organise your pantry, and just a few tips for people who are new to blindness. If they're not aware that there's talking thermometers and talking scales and all sorts of things we can use in the kitchen.
And liquid level indicators, which is always one of my favourite kitchen implements.
Red, let me tell you something funny. I bought a talking kitchen scales recently and I wanted to check its limit. So I put this bag on it that I just brought home and it just went overload, overload, overload. And it hasn't really worked since. So I'd have broken it.
And the Audible version has just been published, hasn't it?
That's right. I'm very excited. It's on Amazon and in Audible.
And the narrator who you've chosen to read Blindness for Beginners is Alice Herman. How did you come across her? And hasn't she got a beautiful voice?
She has got a lovely voice. Alice Herman's is a friend of mine. We actually met at a funeral. But when she got up to speak, my partner and I looked at each other and we went, her voice. We like her voice. And so we approached Alice and she was very happy to come and record the book. And we grew over that period of time with her reading the book. And now we're great friends.
Is that the first book that she's narrated then?
Yes.
Wow. Because she reads as if she's to the manor born.
Oh, great. She'll be very pleased.
And are you a keen audiobook listener yourself?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. While I was gardening, I was listening to a book, which I love. I can be running around the garden planting garlic and reading an audiobook.
So were there any inspirations from books that you've read that guided you in your approach to blindness for beginners?
Not really, because the books that I read when I'm not writing are fictional books, and I tend to write non-fiction. I've always written memoir-type stories, and I like to just get away from that sort of writing into some fantasy world. I really admire writers who can write beautiful fictional stories, so I tend to read those. I've always liked to take note and observe the world, so I think my book has come from many years of being a diarist and then just shaping them into telling an interesting story.
And I believe that there is a literary connection within your family as well.
Ah, yes. My partner, Harry Williamson, is the youngest son of author Henry Williamson, who wrote Tarka the Otter. And we actually went back to Devon in 2009 to do a little bit of filming, because I actually am from UK myself originally, and Harry, my partner, grew up in Devon. So we took lots of film where Tarka first was written, and we brought that back to Australia. And then we were able to play it for a world premiere performance at the Melbourne Town Hall with Harry, my partner, actually playing a guitar symphony that he wrote called Tarka. So it was a very, very interesting trip back in time.
And what are your plans for writing in the future?
I do love writing and I obviously will keep going with that. And I do like writing observational pieces every day. It's interesting how the little things, if we just write the small things, come back and read it in a year's time, and you'll be interested about the things that you wrote about.
Well, as a reader, I thoroughly enjoyed sharing your world. And it's a very upbeat world. I think that's a very important thing to say, that you enjoy the problem solving. It might not always feel like it at the time, but the sense of achievement and joy when you do solve the problem shines through the prose. And I will thoroughly look forward to another volume.
Thank you so much, Red. Thank you.
Maribel Steele, thank you for being a guest on Read On, and do stay in touch.
Blindness for Beginners by Maribel Steele.
Imagining a sunset sky. I was looking upwards towards a cloudy sky, the sun setting like a painting. Obviously, though, most of the 6 million cone cells that are supposed to detect colour in my eyes were not conveying reliable messages to the organ of sight. I could sense the brain becoming impatient as signals via the optic nerve were not being transmitted quickly enough. Brain asked my eyes, "What colour is the sky?" My eyes gazed at the sky more intensely, trying hard to guess the colour. Well, at this time of dusk, logically, it should be a shade of deepening blue, right? My brain likes logic, and in a few nanoseconds, it scanned my childhood memory bank to recall all the blue hues I had stored there. Like the painter Monet, I was eager to capture a sense of light dancing across the vast canvas of the skyline. It was then that I asked, am I seeing through vision-impaired eyes, or am I perhaps seeing through the logical deductions of the brain? I came to the conclusion it was a mixture of both. The internal dialogue shifted to ponder what colour had begun to blanket the evening sky as it turned from a light something to a darker something. I was content to be seeing the whatever it was before my eyes, amused by the relaying of signals and mixing of colours in the brain. My mind chose logical deduction from other body sensitivities too. If the current of air had travelled over my sun-warmed skin, the likelihood would be that a summer's day was shedding her glow, and my eyes could imagine warm shades of vivid pink, crimson yellow, or orange chrome. But the mildness of the day could have easily suggested that the sky was a mixture of cool grey swirling with tinges of mauve purple. As I wondered, a much darker shadow caught my attention from skyline to fence line. It was the deep green blob I knew to be the Australian blackwood tree. I could see the tree's image as a tall and wide dark something, towering up to the night sky, casting a majestic shadow over our garden. The distant sound of a light aircraft gliding across the sky distracted sensitive hearing. I tilted my head towards the sound, pointing my audio antennae, like hobbit ears, to track the stereo effect, from far left to the centre of the sky, and away to the far right. The staccato rhythms of the insect chorus reached a deafening crescendo and dominated the sounds in the night air. The sky had shifted through many shades in a short time, and my brain asked my eyes one more question. Do you remember seeing the evening stars as a little girl? My internal dialogue between heart and eyes replied, vaguely, but I'm happy to imagine them again. Brain, Tell me, what does the night sky look like?
Blindness for Beginners by Meribel Steele is out now in print, ebook, and audio, narrated by Alice Hermans. And Meribel will be back to close the show with the books of her life.
Thanks, Red. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show that's usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. And most of this episode is, but due to current circumstances, some of which is being recorded in a bedroom. We're a few episodes into Julian Fellowes' Belgravia on ITV at the moment, which, of course, has audio description. So I thought I'd travel the archives back to 2016, when the original book was released, in a rather unique way. We'll find out about that in a moment, but first, let's hear from Julian Fellowes himself. Creator of Downton Abbey and a big supporter of RNIB Talking Books, Julian Fellowes has a new novel called Belgravia, and it's being released in a rather unique way. On Audible and on the new Belgravia app, you can read 11 chapters week by week, and it's also available on RNIB Overdrive. Belgravia is the story of a secret that unravels behind the portico doors of London's grandest postcode. Here's Julian Fellowes with more.
Belgravia, which is this novel which I've written and is going to be released in separate episodes, and you get it once a week, and then you also have an accompanying app, and you go on it and you learn more about the characters and you learn more about the houses and more about the history and more about this and that and the other. And so you have this, hopefully, sort of layered experience, which is fun.
So we've just been looking at the audio version. It's in print and in audio.
They get a chapter to read, but if they want to switch to audio, I mean, it is quite extraordinary, to be honest. If they want to switch, they just press a button or something. And Juliet Stevenson has done the audio version, which is marvellous, obviously, because she's marvellous. And suddenly, you know, you're going for a drive or something, and you think, oh, no, I think I'll listen to the next bit. And it picks it up at the page you've got to. So, I mean, how on earth does it know that? But anyway, and then you go back into the house and you click it again and you pick it up and continue to read it on your iPad.
And it's not like anything you've done before. And you've said in the past you're not very tech savvy. Why did you do it this way?
I don't know. It just felt like a kind of departure. It felt entertaining. It was the first time it had ever been done in this form. And I do believe in serial narrative. You know, I think it's why television seems to be leading the field from films at the moment, that the shows we all talk about at the moment tend to be television shows. And somehow there's something about serial narrative that appeals to our consciousness. I don't really know why, as these things go in fashions, but somehow that is now. And this feels like a very now way of telling a story.
And what about the actual story of Belgravia?
Well, Belgravia starts in 1815 at the ball of the Duchess of Richmond on the eve of Waterloo. Actually, Waterloo was about 4 days, 3 days later. They left it for the Battle of Quatre Bras, and then they went on to Waterloo. But, you know, rather tragically, several of the young men at the ball died in their dress uniforms that they'd worn for the dance. So it was quite tragic and has become a kind of iconic party, iconic moment. And that's where the story starts. And then we jump forward 25 years to 1841, which was when Belgravia was just built. I mean, it, obviously it wasn't completed. It went on for some years after that. But Belgrave Square was built and Eaton Place was built and so on. But they were all brand new. And this extraordinary adventure, really, in London, because Lord Westminster had just said to the Cubits, you know, I want you to develop this area as a fashionable place of living. And it was so successful that it became fashionable absolutely straight away. And it didn't develop, you know, out of a village or out of an old street pattern of the city in the Middle Ages or all those other bits of London. It just was put up as a lines and lines of palaces for people to move into. And they did. And that, I think, is so extraordinary that it was fun to celebrate it in a book, really.
And what keeps you interested in that period?
I think I mean, partly people come to me when they want a period drama at the moment. So, you know, I'm slightly confined by that because I do like writing contemporary stuff. It's not that I don't. But there is something about period drama when people, particularly I find women, wanted to achieve things, wanted to be fulfilled, wanted to use their brains, get things done. But they were tremendously confined by the rules and customs of the societies in which they lived. And as a result, you've got that sort of built-in tension, which is what you're always looking for when you're writing something. You want something that's kind of pulling against and driving them all mad and so on. And for a woman in 1841 to do what she wanted to do and use her brain and get things done, but at the same time not be thrown out of society as a rebel, but live within it, took a certain amount of brains and negotiation. And that process, I think, does interest me, you're right.
Where can listeners and readers go?
They can find out all about it on a site called Julian Fellowes's Belgravia. And it's Fellows is with apostrophe S, because I don't like that thing of just putting the apostrophe outside an S. And if they go on to that, then they'll be told everything they need to know to enjoy it. They can download it. They get the first chapter, I say, episode, they say, free. And then they have to decide whether they want to go on with it. And then they can either buy it week by week, or they can pay $9.99 and get the whole thing, but delivered once a week.
Thanks to Julian Fellowes, speaking there in 2016 when the Book of Belgravia was first released. There was a reference in that interview to RNIB Overdrive, which by the time you listen to this will have been switched off and replaced with Reading Services, which can be accessed and signed up to at readingservices.rnib.org.uk or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now let's hear more from the publishers of Julian Fellowes' Belgravia on that unique way it was released. A new book from author Julian Fellowes is being released initially in a digital format, one chapter or episode per week in both e-text and audio via a dedicated app, and also available to blind and partially sighted listeners in audio via RNIB Overdrive. It's called Belgravia, and it sounds like this.
The past, as we have been told so many times, is a foreign country where things are done differently. This may be true, indeed it patently is true, when it comes to morals or customs, the role of women, aristocratic government, and a million other elements of our daily lives. But there are similarities, too. Ambition, envy, rage, greed, kindness, selflessness, and above all, love, have always been as powerful in motivating choices as they are today.
That's Juliet Stevenson reading from Julian Fellowes' Belgravia. Joining me to tell me more are Marissa Hussey, the Digital Development and Technical Director at Orion, and Susan Howe, who's the Rights, Audio and Digital Director. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about the story itself.
It's very much a wonderful sort of period drama, the sort of thing that Julian Fellowes does so brilliantly. It's historical. It's set in the early 19th century on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo. And the first episode has the most amazing scene of the ball prior to the battle. And we meet some of our key characters.
His Royal Highness, the Prince of Orange.
A pleasant-looking young man approached the host and hostess, and the Duchess, her back as straight as a ramrod, plunged into a deep court curtsy. The Duke of Wellington did not arrive much before midnight, but he was cool enough about it when he did. To James Trenchard's intense delight, the Duke looked about the ballroom, and on spotting him, walked over.
At the end of that episode, and it's all done in true wonderful Julian Fellowes style, we're left on a real cliffhanger because one of our major characters has seen something that's truly shocked her, and we don't know why. And then we're led in then to the start of the story proper. That's very much the prologue. And we fast forward 25 years. And then it develops from there, really, in the way that Julian Fellowes, the master of that period drama, develops the characters, the family dramas, the social climbing, which is wonderful because it was such a period of change and all the new merchants coming through and are really upsetting the aristocratic classes. And he does all of that beautifully. And of course, his dialogue is second to none. So I don't want to give too much away, but that's roughly how it goes.
Well, if it isn't the magician.
Richmond beamed quite jovially. If he was surprised to find this tradesman in his drawing room, you could not have told it.
Do you remember we made some plans in the event of the reservists being called to arms? I recall it very well. Your schedule, I mean, Duke.
And tell us why you decided to release it in the way it was released.
We were really, as a company, I mean, I think publishing is facing many challenges at the moment with all sort of technology. I mean, like all industries, it's been very much disrupted, and we're always looking for the new and how we continue to reach our audience and our readers effectively. And I think we had a bit of a brainstorming and decided that the Charles Dickens idea of the serialisation worked incredibly well when it did, and whether there was something that we could do and give it a sort of 21st century makeover. And it's been very interesting. We have had a lot of people who clearly like to binge read and are saving the episodes, but others who, we get such amazing feedback on social media, others who are very, very keen and waiting literally for that Thursday morning for the new episode to be released. So I think that was where the idea came from, really. It was, how can we reach the audience? How can we do something different? And as part of that, we also wanted to offer more than just a straightforward story. So we looked at other areas of the market, and one of the big areas for us that's changing and growing and has been grown dramatically in the last 3 years is the audio area. And for this reason, we decided that we'd focus very much on the audio and release that as part of the story at the beginning, ahead of the print version. All of the episodes are released digitally along with the audio. And on top of that, we've also looked at a raft of big range of extra content, which backs up the story, some historical facts, some facts around the fashions of the time, the customs of the day, the history. So some sort of context for the story, which we're finding that readers are also really, really enjoying. So our focus has been around the story, the audio, and the extra content.
Ladies in Belgravia, they don't have a job, but they are fully occupied in getting changed all day. They have a series of changes of costumes, costumes so complicated that they need their ladies' maid to help them, and sometimes even more people as well.
So was it written with the episodic nature in mind?
It certainly was, and that in itself was a really exciting, an adventure, as Julian Fellowes likes to call it. He worked very, very hard on each chapter. We had a team, actually, in the end, who worked with him. He did the Bible, as it were, and all the storylines. And as they do in television, we had a historical consultant and someone else who came along and did some of the work. And Julian very much took it in hand and then went over it, introducing his amazing dialogue. So it was written with that in mind, but the whole idea at the end was that we would release it as a novel as well.
Now, Marissa, how much work goes on at the back end of a project like this?
Well, we have been working on this for about a year. This was brand new in a lot of ways. We didn't have any structure for releasing content direct to consumers. The e-commerce aspects that needed to be built all needed to be built from scratch. And then even just the technology around the reading and the listening, we've tried to replicate much more established e-readers and audio listening applications in a really, really short span of time. So that's all been very challenging.
And it's incredible, the fact that you can read the print version on whatever device you have and then just press a button and it starts reading it to you as well.
Yep. And we found that so far a lot of people have really liked that option, which we expected, and it's why we chose to create the product as both the text and the audio edition.
Now, Julian Fellowes himself, he's confessed that he's not very tech savvy. Can he use the app?
Yes, I think he undersells himself. Absolutely. I handed him my iPad and he was off. He knew exactly what to do.
Now, you've got Juliet Stevenson narrating the audio version. Were you pleased to get her?
We were so delighted when she accepted the invitation, because her audience is perfect for this project. And And she read it so beautifully. I mean, the way she brought the characters to life, the way she manages to do the male voices in particular, I mean, it was just stunning.
Have you got it?
His excitement was palpable. There was something charming in his enthusiasm, this plump, balding master of business who was suddenly as excited as a child on Christmas Eve. Very slowly, squeezing the last drop out of the moment, Sophia opened her reticule and carefully removed some squares of white pasteboard.
"I have three,"
she said, savouring the occasion. "One for you, one for Mama, and one for me."
Now, RNIB are releasing the audio version at the same time as yourselves, and it's proved very popular there. What about in the wider world?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed is that there are, I think as I referred to slightly earlier, is there are a core number of people who absolutely cannot wait to read the next episode, which is exactly what we wanted to do. So all the people that have signed up to the website or signed up to Facebook, we're in touch with them. And it's very interesting seeing what their reaction is and what people respond to, whether it's certain characters, whether it is the audio. We can test and measure all this sort of thing. So as a project as a whole, it's fascinating and we're learning a lot. And I certainly think the readers are really enjoying it.
Will you follow up maybe with even a sequel to Belgravia or perhaps a different book and author?
Well, that is the intention, that we would do a sequel. But I think the way that we've developed the technology that sits behind the website and the app, the idea was very much so that we could do other projects or other books, or whether it's non-fiction or science fiction or fantasy, or establish where our audience might be for this type of approach.
So, Marissa, the next book will be a lot easier to do than this one.
I hope so. As Susan says, this was built with the intention of creating a framework and creating a structure that we could use going forward, and that this would be something that changed our business. So that was a focus for us all along the way and during the development, is that this is something that could continue to grow and continue to be useful to people and exciting for us. You know, one of the most exciting things is the bonus features within the text, and then also if you're listening to the audio, you can go and view them separately. It's kind of an inherent second screening. So, you know, we know that people are, while they're listening or while they're watching something, are going to go look for more information. And we've kind of presented that within the experience, which we think is another really exciting thing, that people will continue to do that, and the more information we can provide, the better and the more fun the experience.
So this is the morning dress, so Anne might wear this from about 9 to about 12. Then she'd probably have a luncheon meeting, so she set off in her luncheon dress. This is a more formal engagement dress, men might see her. Then in the afternoon, it's afternoon tea dress. That's just for ladies, but we know what ladies are like.
Now, how important is the audio format so your books are accessible to everyone?
It's very important, and it's an area that we see great potential. And one of the interesting things that we're looking at is widening what we actually put into audio. And obviously now with the downloadability, it's meant that as publishers we can look at a wide range of audio of titles that previously we could never have published in audio because they would be too long, too expensive, and the market wasn't there. But now with the download market, we're seeing a range of titles selling in a way that they didn't before, and a real take-up in audio for all sorts of non-fiction, history, business books, health books. We've even been looking at some cookery titles. So we're really widening it, and I think that's very important, and we'd love to be working more with the RNIB on those sort of titles.
Now, talking of RNIB, if someone who's listening to Belgravia and wants some of those extra features, how accessible is it?
Part of our testing process and, you know, making sure that everything was sort of ready to bring the product to market was testing accessibility and every possible thing that could be broken or how people access this this application, and, you know, testing to make sure it works. So even if you are listening via OverDrive, if you want to download the app is free to download, and you can still sort of experience all of the bonus features and things like that around the first episode, because that is free in the app. So you can listen to it there, of course. You can explore the map of Belgravia as long as you have the correct keyboard turned on your phone or your iPad or whatever device you have. Everything will be read aloud to you, and it's a pretty good experience.
Now, if anyone wants to find out more and they're online, where can they go?
They can go to www.julianfellowsbelgravia.com. Alternatively, just searching Belgravia or Julian Fellows Belgravia will get you to where you need to go.
Marissa Hussey and Susan Hout, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood. Belgravia, written by Julian Fellows and narrated by Juliet Stevenson, is TB23163. It's also available in Braille and giant print. For more information about the library and the wide range of services offered by RNIB, including talk and support, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Now, before we return to Mary Bell Steele to share the books of her life, one of the great joys of reading is swapping recommendations with others. When I finished a good book, I can't wait to spread the word and find out what others have been enjoying. Talking about books can provide a welcome relief to thinking about the coronavirus too. So I always look forward to your Educating Read suggestions. When author Sam Hepburn appeared on the show to talk about her latest psychological thriller, I asked her for a recommendation, and she had no hesitation in directing me towards the shelves of 19th century fiction. Lady Audley's Secret by Mary Elizabeth Braddon was published in 1862, but, like many Victorian classics, it appeared first serialised in a weekly magazine, so there are plenty of cliffhangers, and a fiendish plot that caused quite a stir at the time. In fact, Lady Audley's Secret has been described as the most sensationally successful of all the sensation novels.
Choose between the two alternatives, Mr. Audley. Shall you or I find my brother's murderer? He looked in her face and saw that her resolution was the fruit of no transient womanish enthusiasm which would give way under the iron hand of difficulty. Her beautiful features, naturally statuesque in their noble outlines, seemed transformed into marble by the rigidity of her expression. The face in which he looked was the face of a woman whom death only could turn from her purpose. "I have grown up in an atmosphere of suppression," she said quietly. "I have stifled and dwarfed the natural feelings of my heart until they have become unnatural in their intensity. I have been allowed neither friends nor lovers. My mother died when I was very young. My father has always been to me what you saw him today. I have had no one but my brother. All the love that my heart can hold has been centred upon him. Do you wonder, then, that when I hear that his young life has been ended by the hand of treachery, that I wish to see vengeance done upon the traitor?"
The plot revolves around Audley Court, a country house estate in Essex, where the elderly baronet, Sir Michael Audley, has just married a much younger and very beautiful governess, Lucy Graham. Very little is known of the new Lady Audley's past, but when Sir Michael's nephew, Robert, arrives with his friend George Tallboys, Lucy begins to behave very oddly, trying hard to avoid them. George has recently returned from Australia, where he's made his fortune, only to discover that in his absence, his wife has died. He's distraught, and Robert brings him to Audley Court for a break. But once there, George too begins to act strangely, and then he disappears without a word. Suspecting foul play, and that Lady Audley is hiding something, Robert sets out to investigate. The plot owes a lot to the real Road Hill House murder of 1860. It too involved the marriage between a governess and an older, richer man. Its lurid details fascinated and appalled the Victorian public and inspired a slew of other sensation novels, such as The Woman in White and The Moonstone. The Roadhill case was brilliantly re-examined by Kate Summerscale in The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, which is also in the RNIB library. Indeed, the painstaking methods employed by Robert Audley as he crisscrosses the country, interviewing witnesses and gathering evidence against his suspect, do mirror those of Mr. Witcher. It's a fast-moving investigation that makes full use of the newly constructed railway system. But while on one level it's an early example of detective fiction, the book's themes run much deeper than that. It reflects contemporary anxieties about the effects of the Industrial Revolution. Rapid urbanisation and the spread of the railways brought huge social change. People had never been so mobile or so anonymous. The book plays on fears about stranger danger. Its opening paragraph paints a perfect picture of Audley Court before an outsider came to live in the family's midst.
It lay low down in a hollow, rich with fine old timber and luxuriant pastures, and you came upon it through an avenue of limes, bordered on either side by meadows, over the high hedges of which the cattle looked inquisitively at you as you passed, wondering perhaps what you wanted, for there was no thoroughfare, and unless you were going to the court, you had no business there at all.
The outside world brings change and misfortune with it, but the book also questions the wisdom of a society that sets such store by ancestry and appearance, and that seeks to put women on pedestals.
Good heavens, exclaimed Robert, as he watched the merry party of equestrians until they disappeared under the archway. What does all this mean? How charmingly she sits her horse. What a pretty figure, too, and fine, candid, brown, rosy face. But to fly at a fellow like that without the least provocation, that's the consequence of letting a girl follow the hounds. She learns to look at everything in life as she does at 6 feet of timber or sunk fence. She goes through the world as she goes across country, straight ahead and over everything. Such a nice girl as she might have been, too, if she'd been brought up in Fig Tree Court. If I ever marry and have daughters, which remote contingency may heaven forfend, they shall be educated in paper buildings, take their sole exercise in the temple gardens, and they shall never go beyond the gates till they are marriageable, when I will take them straight across Fleet Street to St. Dunstan's Church and deliver them into the hands of their husbands.
By exploring the motivations and psychology of her characters and the society that they live in, Braddon gives extra punch to the question that she raises about sanity and imprisonment. So, at times, I forgot that I was reading a novel that was written over 150 years ago. It rattles along at a great pace. The dialogue is spot on, and the characters have a full range of faults and foibles that you'd expect to find in one of today's historical page-turners. And this impression was only enhanced by Jenny Coversack's brilliant narration that I downloaded from the RNIB Reading Services Library via EasyReader. She uses a full palette of voices, which brought all the characters vividly to life. In case you haven't guessed the ending, I loved this book. So if you're looking for a bit of escapism, I can't recommend it enough. Thanks again to Sam Hepburn for a great recommendation. Lady Audley's Secret by Mary Elizabeth Braddon is available as TB20551. Is there a book that you'd like to tell us about? Maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share. Drop us a line by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk. Now it's back to Marybelle Steele to share the books of her life. Marybelle, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading?
Well, there was one from a very early memory that actually was read to me by my father, and that was the story of Thumbelina. I just loved the little girl and the little tulip flower and her adventure, and I just really enjoyed that. But it was only until I look back now as an adult that I can see a parallel to my own life, where Thumbelina has to say farewell to the sunlight and she has to go and live underground, and she's supposedly to marry the creature, the mole, but she does escape and she does end up in a beautiful fairy world with her fairy prince. And I just think that that was something that really caught my imagination as a child.
Thumbelina by Hans Christian Andersen is contained in a compendium of fairy tales and pantomimes, that's TB704134. But instead, we thought we'd play you a clip of Tarka the Otter, written by Mirabel's father-in-law, Henry Williamson.
The sycamore was riven and burnt by lightning, yet sap still gave it a few leaves for summer. Its old trunk was beloved by two mouse-like birds which crept up the whitest tinder and held themselves by their spread tails as they looked in the cracks for woodlice and spiders. Every spring, this pair of tree creepers made a nest between the trunk and loose bark of twigs, tinderwood, dry grasses, and feathers. Here burrowed the bumblebees to their homes in the crannies, and when the first frosts stiffened the grasses, they tucked their heads under their forelegs and slept, if they did not die, until the primroses came again. Here, when the trees were nearly bare, waddled Iggywick, the grunting Vuzpeg, or hedgehog, with a coat of the tree's dry leaves, black-patched with autumn's falling mark, and on the earth he curled and closed meek eyes and dozed into a long rest. The tree was the friend of all, and it had one human friend, who as a child had seen it first when trailing in summer after her father hunting the otters of the brook. She had imagined that the old charred sycamore was a giant with many legs, who had been burnt in a fire and had rushed to the bank to cool himself, and that its roots, bared by floods, were thin legs bent at wooden knees and fixed in the water. The brook was determined to drown the giant, who was burrowing his toes for a hold. The maid grew tall and beautiful, but still the old giant sat cooling his 13 legs, and every June, when she passed by with her father, following the otter hounds, he wore a fresh green wig.
Tarka the Otter, narrated by Nicholas Courtney, and it's TB 13047. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
There is an Australian author called Kate Morton, and I love all her books, so it would be hard to choose one. She has The Shifting Fog is one, and I just think that with all of Kate Morton's books, I'm very happy to recommend. I love how she creates the characters and the way they grow. And when you finish the book, you just feel like, oh, those characters, they've gone. So the development of character and story, the historical fiction, often set in England. And I think that just brings me back to my English roots as well.
The doors sweep open. Music and laughter crescendo. We are in the midst of a glittering party. The atmosphere is one of post-war extravagance. Sequins, feathers, silks as far as the eye can see. Coloured Chinese paper lanterns strung above the lawn flutter in the light summer's breeze. A jazz band plays, and women dance the Charleston. We weave through the crowd of assorted laughing faces. They turn toward us, accepting champagne from the servant's tray. A woman with bright red lipstick, a fat man made pink by excitement and alcohol, a thin old lady dripping in jewels and holding aloft a long tapered cigarette holder, emitting a lazy curlicue of smoke. There is a tremendous bang, and people gaze above as glittering fireworks tear open the night sky. There are squeals of pleasure, and some applause. Reflections of Catherine wheels colour upturned faces. The band spins on, and women dance faster and faster.
Caroline Lee narrating The Shifting Fog by Kate Morton is available commercially. It's also known by the title The House at Riverton. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, as recent as having listened to the final chapter today, A Gentleman in Moscow. And I think the author is Amor Tor. Anyway, the book is an amazing, gorgeous story set in Russia of, I can't even explain it. It's so wonderful. So that was very impressive. What I enjoyed about this book was that my partner and I listened to it, the entire book, during our car trips to and from our bush block or elsewhere in Victoria. And so we were able to share this book together, and that was actually a real delight.
After 2 weeks, her boudoir began to look like an Arabian tent with fabrics of every colour underfoot. Olga, the 60-year-old Georgian, who had met the Count at the door of Suite 208 and who had faithfully served as the actress's dresser since 1920, initially eyed her mistress's behaviour with seasoned indifference. But one night, when Anna had dropped a blue backless dress on top of a white silk gown, Olga observed matter-of-factly, "My dear, you are acting like a child. If you do not pick up your clothes, I shall have no choice but to give you a spanking." Anna Urbanova turned as red as a jar of jam. "Pick up my clothes?" she shouted. "You want me to pick up my clothes? Then I shall pick them up." Gathering up 20 outfits in her arms, she marched to the open window and cast them into the street below. With the greatest satisfaction, the actress watched as they fluttered and coasted to the ground. When she wheeled about to confront her dresser in triumph, Olga coolly observed how entertained the neighbours would be by this evidence of the famous actress's petulance. Then she turned and left the room. Switching off the lights and climbing into bed, Anna sputtered like a candle. "What do I care what the neighbours will say about my petulance? What do I care what St. Petersburg will say, or all of Russia?" But at 2 in the morning, having tossed and turned, Anna Urbanova tiptoed down the grand staircase, slipped out into the street, and gathered up her garments one by one.
Leighton Pugh narrating A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Tawiz, which is TB23963. Maribel Steele, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back live from our bedrooms at the same time next week.
Will you have changed out of your pyjamas by then? And to get rid of that image from your minds, don't forget that we're also available as a podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate or leave a review.
And you can find us both on Twitter. Red is at RedSale, RedSzell, and I'm at @talking_books.
Farewell until next week. Stay safe, be kind, and don't forget to lose yourself in a good book.
See you next week.